Okay, Mr. Burley.
Good afternoon. Chris Aberly for Brian Scott Sperlin. Mr. Sperlin was convicted on three counts. We're challenging two of those counts. Count two charged Mr. Sperlin with making a false statement under oath when he answered the question on the trustee's questionnaire, was any property left by your parents at the time of death? The government has argued that that question means that did your parents or your spouse's parents have any property interest in any property at the time that they died, irrespective of its disposition? And they argue that Mr. Sperlin knew that his father-in-law had passed an interest in real estate to his mother-in-law several years before Mr. Sperlin filed for bankruptcy. Our position is, even under that theory, the evidence is not sufficient. The government presented no evidence of the status of the ownership of Mr. Fogelman, as the father-in-law, his status of the ownership of the property at the time he died, nor did they present any evidence that Mr. Sperlin would know, should know, had any reason to know how Mr. Fogelman possessed that property when he died. But the most important part about this claim, from our perspective, is that we believe that given the purpose of the questionnaire, the context of the question relative to other questions, the only reasonable interpretation of the question, and the only one for which the answer has any material import, is did your parents or your spouse's parents leave any property to you or to your spouse when they died? Now, we have pointed to several places in the record that support that argument. I would like to point out two more that I actually overlooked when I was reading this record. The first one is at Trial Volume 3, page 248. It's the testimony of Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson is the trustee bankruptcy. He wrote the question. He gave the questionnaire to Mr. Sperlin. And during the cross-examination by Mr. Whatley on behalf of Deborah Sperlin, Mr. Wilson said, the real thrust, quote, of question five is, if they are not alive, did they leave you anything? The other place in the record I want to point out is during the jury instructions, volume five, page 939. The judge is reading the jury instructions that the parties have approved, and he says, quote, specifically, the indictment accuses the defendants of declaring under penalty of perjury on their bankruptcy questionnaire that they had been left no property by their parents at the time of death. And in fact, they had not. So the conviction on that count must therefore be reversed. Now, on count three, this charges Mr. Sperlin with having filed a bankruptcy petition for the purpose of executing or concealing an alleged fraud that he perpetrated against 1000 South Michigan Avenue LLC, which I'll call SMA. Out of $700,000 in financing fees that he could not pay back. Now, Mr. Sperlin maintains that even if he had devised this fraud, which he denies, the fraud scheme was fully executed no less than 2.5 years before he filed bankruptcy. Therefore, this filing of the bankruptcy cannot be considered an act of executing or concealing the fraud. Now, this section, 18 U.S.C. 157, is very seldom used. There's very, very few cases interpreting this statute. But those that you'll find, or you will find none that involve this type of situation. Rather, what you find is a situation where the bankruptcy filing is itself an integral part of the fraud. Thus, in this court's ruling in U.S. v. Daniels, you have the defendant holding himself out as someone who can stop people's homes from being foreclosed upon. And what he would do is he would have the homeowner convey a percentage of the property to him or to a shell company that he would create. Then he would have the shell company file for bankruptcy, and then he would shuffle these around from shell company to shell company. Here, you have a fully executed fraud. And then 2.5 years later, you have the filing for bankruptcy. If this can ever be a violation of 157, at a minimum, and this is according to the legislative history, the government would have to show that when he was making his false representations to SMA, he, at that time, intended to file bankruptcy. The government has not made that showing and doesn't even premise its criminal liability on that theory. And finally, as to the concealing aspect, did he file this petition for the purpose of concealing the fraud? As the government has argued, we believe that begs the question. The debt is there. It's on the table. Whether he owed it because there was a breach of contract or fraud is really the question. And if it's a fraud, and if he files bankruptcy successfully, he did so because he has already concealed this scheme. The judgment in bankruptcy is not a judgment that there was no fraud. And in fact, it poses no obstacle to proving that it's fraud. And for that reason, we don't believe that the filing can be regarded as concealing that earlier fraud either. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eberle. Save time for rebuttal. Mr. Whatley.
Good afternoon. I'm William Whatley. I represent Deborah Sperling, the wife. The primary issue I would like to address relates to count one, but it does touch as well on count two because of the charging language. And that issue is whether or not a joint debtor here, my wife, my client, who is named as a joint debtor by an electronically filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy, under circumstances where the husband 2 years, almost 3 years before, had obtained a general durable power of attorney from the wife, which did not specify that there was a power given the husband to declare bankruptcy, engaged an attorney, had the information given to the bankruptcy attorney, prepared the schedules, presumably went into the bankruptcy attorney's office and signed a precursor petition or questionnaire, filed the bankruptcy completely without the wife's knowledge. There is no evidence that my client knew what her husband was doing. There is no evidence, no direct evidence of any communication between the bankruptcy attorney who filed the petition in her name. In fact, if you look at page 2 of the red brief, if you look at issue 1A, the government from the start says that the issue is whether or not she participated in the bankruptcy after the filing. What this means is the government is not even contending, as I understand it, that she directly participated in the preparation of those schedules and the Statement of Financial Affairs, which I'll refer to as the SOFA. So if she didn't prepare these and that she didn't prepare any or sign any questionnaires or a precursor petition, then she didn't make the admittedly bad disclosures and do the concealment by way of the schedules and the SOFA. Okay, I hope you have a copy of this timeline. Up in the top left-hand corner, I have the date of the execution of the power of attorney, Deborah Sperling, to her husband. That was dated September 30th, 2002. It's a general power of attorney. I've cited cases, I've cited a few bankruptcy district court cases where a general power of attorney is condemned. There are cases going the other way. There's only two circuits that I could find that have spoken on it, the Ninth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit. They seem to condemn the practice. It seems that the remedy, though, is for the person named. They can come in and move for a dismissal. In other words, if I'm named unbeknownst to me as a bankrupt, say by my wife, and I found out about it, I can come in and move for a dismissal. I couldn't give the amount of time, I couldn't graphically show the amount of time that passed between September 30, 2002 and the filing of this bankruptcy. There is not a shred of evidence between those two dates. It's 20 days short of 3 years. There is no evidence that my client, Deborah Sperling, had any knowledge that this bankruptcy petition was to be filed. In fact, there is no evidence that she knew until the eve of this creditor's meeting. The creditor meeting was almost 2 months. Creditor's meeting was about 2 months later, lacked a couple of days being 2 months later. She found out it. The record shows that she found out on the eve of the creditor's meeting, November 7th. Her husband told her, we have to go to our creditor's meeting. Her testimony is unrefuted. So the two intervening events, the Elliott Street sale by my client's mother, represented by Brian Sperling, which took place, looks like 12 days after the Chapter 7 petition was filed, there is no indication that she knew that. Incidentally, that piece of property, that Elliott Street property, was not property that came from Cade Fogelman, my client's deceased father. There is no indication on the second event, the Tennyson Oaks sale. This was the matrimonial domicile. It was titled by her some 5 years before. She titled this property away to a LLC owned by her husband. It was declared by him to be his separate paraternal property. So there's no indication that she knows on October 6th. Now, she signed off on it only as an intervener. The transactional real estate lawyer, Daniels, testified that she was not signing as an owner. She just signed on it because her sale to her husband 5 years before had been inadequate consideration. I will try to summarize on the 3 minutes that I have left. I see I'm about running out of time. I'll be happy to entertain any questions or try to answer any questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Butler.
Thank you.
You've saved time for rebuttal. Ms. Cashier.
May it please the court. I will address first the issue raised by Mr. Aberle regarding the real crux is, did they leave you anything? Elsewhere in the testimony of the trustee, he states that the questionnaire is geared toward determining, and I cannot give you a specific record site right now, but it is geared towards enabling the trustee to determine what assets may be available to the estate of the bankrupt that the bankrupt does not realize are available for disbursement to the creditors before he gives it a no asset determination. And that's what ultimately happened with this particular trustee. He determined that it was a no asset bankruptcy based upon the answers that were given to him and the schedules that were filed. In cross-examination of Deborah Sperling during the trial, she was asked about that particular question, and she specifically acknowledged that the answer on the questionnaire was incorrect. It should have been yes, as asked. It does not imply, did the person leave that money to you?
The context in which that question was asked, and I probably should have gone back and looked at the record, but I think it's perfectly reasonable to interpret it two different ways. And so the way that's argued on behalf of the gentleman here, I have a little problem with that conviction. And so when I go to the question that she says, where she says that it was false, what was the context of that question? What had the government laid out its position of what it thought the question meant? I mean, when she says that it's false, is she saying it's false because of her understanding of what the government position is now, or was it false at the time that she made it and that she was there at the creditors' meeting and didn't correct it?
No, you're talking about the context of the questioning that occurred at trial. The government was pretty clear, I think, about what the question was. It was literally, this is the question, what would be the answer? And the answer would have been yes, if the question was taken in that context. Mrs. Ferland, throughout her testimony, kept saying that she was talked over and no one allowed her to speak, and she was not allowed to say what she wanted to say. She repeatedly said that. So it was difficult to cross-examine her because she kept interjecting those statements. And when you read her testimony, you will see that it was a difficult cross-examination. But the question was asked straight. The literal question is this, and what is the literal answer to it? And if you want to add words to it or interpret it a different way, that it means something that is not on its face, well, and that's what she is arguing she did.
Answers.
That's what they're arguing they did.
Answers. No, I did not fill this out.
Oh, she did not fill it out. Her husband did complete it. But she acknowledged at the hearing, and the trustee made an explanation before each debtor was called up for the individual meeting, made an announcement that in the joint bankruptcies, anyone, the two persons...
I don't think you're understanding my question.
Oh.
The question that you say was concrete and that she answered, and it's a good answer. I mean, your response is good. That wasn't accurate, was it? And she says, no, I did not fill this out. She gave two answers to one question. Or is it she answering one question and saying no, and then volunteering, I did not fill this out?
Your Honor, she did say she did not fill it out, but she also said what the answer should have been and that the answer on the questionnaire itself was false. She does say that in her cross-examination.
I got you.
Okay.
How is that substantial evidence of the fact that she knew it was false when her husband filled it out, even though she had nothing to do with filling it out? How does that relate?
Well,
back?
She signed that document indicating that she had read it and that everything on it was correct. And as I was saying before the people were actually called into their little meeting, they were told in the joint bankruptcy situation, if one person answers the question, if the other person disagrees, they should make that statement. They should be clear as to whether the person's answer who is answering is in fact the answer that both of them agree to.
But she didn't sign this one. She did sign that.
She did sign it, Your Honor.
It wasn't one that was signed for her by her husband.
That is correct, and it was not
on the other.
And it was, to the best of anyone's recollection, because her testimony is unclear, he did not testify at trial. And the trustee was not really certain about this, but the form is typically sent to the attorney for the debtors. And that he understood that they were supposed to fill it out at the time with their attorney.
Now, with respect to this, I think you've answered the question pretty well. With respect to the defense that was brought up about not knowing, I took that to mean that that related to her knowledge of these other properties being sold and that this the power of attorney was being used to sell these properties, and she didn't know anything about it, and she wasn't trying to hide it. I thought that was the defense that was that opposing counsel was talking about.
I don't think that's necessarily the defense that was used. She signed, for example, on the Tennyson Oaks property that was sold between the filing of the bankruptcy petition and the creditors meeting. She actually signed documents as an intervenor on that property. But during that time, immediately prior to the filing of the bankruptcy and even after the creditors' meeting, there are numerous checks.
She's writing checks.
Exactly, Your Honor. Using other accounts that were not mentioned by at any point, at any time in the bankruptcy at all. And it's obvious that she is avoiding using the People's State Bank one, which was their personal one that was revealed in the bankruptcy, was the only one disclosed.
She's using the accounts that were used for the to be the deposit accounts for the Elliott Street properties that were sold.
They used a number of them. There was the Landmark Bank account that was their personal joint savings and personal joint checking. But then it was also at Landmark Bank was the International Management Holdings, which held the ownership of, I think, two companies.
So the money from these sales that were deposited into accounts, and that was proven.
Yes.
That were not revealed, but she was using those accounts.
Correct.
At the same time, not revealing any assets of those accounts.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is correct. And she was also stating incorrectly that she was self-employed or that she was employed by International Oil, which was a company that was not disclosed likewise. And she professed not to know anything about her husband's businesses, but yet she was employed by one of his companies that was not disclosed. So we've jumped over to the power of attorney argument, I think, to some extent. She may not have visited with the attorney prior to the filing. However, she did have an opportunity to withdraw. She saw and heard the answers at the creditors' meeting, and she knew that they were not true. She knew that they did not have the use of the car by permission of her mother. It was owned by a corporation that was not disclosed at that time. She also knew that there were two other cars that they had exclusive use of that were owned by this corporation that had only recently been sold to her elderly mother. I'm trying to think of some other aspects here of that particular thing. She, I think the clearest indication of her knowledge is the writing, the checks that were deposited and written and the various bank accounts that were used for them. She had experienced also, she had participated in the prior bankruptcy and the prior bankruptcy creditors hearing. So she was not unaware or taken completely by surprise in that regard. She was the intervener in the sale. I believe that takes care of those things. Are there any other questions regarding the count two? With respect to count three, the fraud, there aren't many cases using 157.1 as the basis for the conviction. However, defendant clearly participated and concocted a scheme to defraud 1000 SMA, the corporation in Chicago. And when it became apparent that they were not going to go away and they sued to recover the funds, he had only one way out at that point, and that was to concoct further stories about this person, James Hill, the attorney in Dallas, Texas, who was only recently deceased and had absconded with all of those funds, plus supposedly some personal funds of Sperling's. The statute says it can be for the purpose of executing or concealing. This was for the purpose of completing the execution of the scheme to make sure that the funds were his because he'd already used them, and concealing the fact that it was a scheme to defraud by alleging this other person out there who had absconded with the funds. So it's both is what he did. And the statute clearly covers this type of activity. He used the bankruptcy court for a purpose for which it was not intended. The major debts on there were the $705,000 and then a $30,000 fee owed to a law firm. Everything else was just small potatoes. There just weren't any other debts. So it was clear that he was out to get rid of the big one, the $705,000, and it was a completion as well as a concealment of his fraud against that company. Any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Cassier.
Thank you.
Mr. Averly, you save time for a vote.
The problem with count three is what the government is doing, quite simply, is saying Mr. Sperling committed a crime by filing a bankruptcy petition and listing a debt that is not dischargeable. That's a crime. But it's not 157. It's 152. They charged the wrong crime. For all the reasons I've said before, this is not a filing bankruptcy doesn't conceal anything, nor does it execute that which has already been executed. Regarding question five, even under their interpretation, you don't have the answer. No, is not wrong. Was there anything that, as she said, the trustee wants to know what there is that's reachable in this bankruptcy proceeding? And the answer is nothing. There wasn't anything. So the answer wasn't really false. In any case, to the extent it was false, like did he have a watch when he died that he gave to somebody? Well, that's not material. But given that the government says in opening that what we're trying to prove is that property was left to the Sperlings, you've got Mr. Wilson testifying in cross-examination that the purpose, the real thrust, was to show that property was left to the Sperlings, and then you've got the court in the jury instructions saying this is what they're trying to prove for guilt, that they left the property to them. And finally, you got question six. Question six says, after question five, did your parents leave any property? Question six says, if you inherit anything in the next 6 months, you need to report it. Under the circumstances, even if this was not intended, it clearly was reasonable for Mr. Sperling to believe that this was the meaning of the question such that his answer could not be considered criminal. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Averly. Mr. Whiteley, you've saved time for both.
Thank you. This case was tried against Deborah Sperling just as if she had committed fraud in filing and knew about the fraudulent schedules and statement of financial affairs. The trustee sat on that stand. It's 125 pages of testimony where he said over and over, they committed fraud, they failed to disclose, they didn't list their assets, they didn't disclose this property or the existence of these companies or the directorship. Deborah Sperling didn't put any of that information in the schedules or the statement of financial affairs, and Deborah Sperling did not sign that bankruptcy petition. The amazing thing is, Trustee Wilson, you can read his testimony, 95 pages where he tears these schedules apart. He is completely unaware that Deborah Sperling was brought into this filing by this three-year-old power of attorney. There is no evidence that she knew beforehand that he was filing, and there is no evidence. Look at what the attorney did. The attorney never talked to her, never spoke to her on the phone, never came face to face. The first time he saw her was on the day of the creditors' meeting.
Well, that's now, what I want you to respond to, the contention that, well, that may be she didn't prepare these schedules and such, but she was there at the creditors' meeting and heard what they said, and if, you know, a joint debtor is saying something, you better correct it if it's wrong.
Judge Parksdale, I'm glad you asked that question because I looked at that last night. The last thing I did, I looked at that. That's Exhibit 7B, I believe. That's the introductory remarks. I see where the exhibit went into evidence. The trustee never testified that he read this to those assembled. There's still no direct evidence that she ever heard this. Now, she sat there like a knot on the log and watched him and should have withdrawn herself from this. But that does not make her guilty of his misrepresentations and his fraudulent schedules. There is no evidence at that creditor's hearing that those schedules were made known to her. She didn't know what was in the schedules. And the amazing thing, the trustee wasn't aware of the power of attorney. He actually asked them, did you sign? She has not heard. You can't hear her in that creditor's meeting. Her response is, she's not heard. Look at 7D. I can't hear her on the tape recording. You never hear her. She utters a four-word fragment about getting her Social Security card. You cannot hear her. If she said that she signed those, that does not make her aware of what her husband and the bankruptcy lawyer put in the schedules. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Whatley. Your case is under submission. Mr. Averly.